I'm Dean Jackson. He's Joe Polish. And this is the I Love Marketing Podcast. Everybody, it's Dean Jackson and no Joe Polish today, but welcome to the I Love Marketing Podcast, and I am very excited about today's episode. I mentioned in our introduction there, we have Brian Franklin and Jennifer Russell with us, so welcome you guys.
Great to be here. Thank you, Dean.
Very exciting. Now, where in the world are you guys today?
We're in Alameda, which is, for those of you that know, it's an island in the San Francisco Bay. And it's a sunny day today. It's beautiful weather these days.
Awesome. Well, guys, I thank you for coming on today because, you know, I've gotten to know you guys over the last couple of years here. And I was really excited to get to spend some real quality time with you guys in Chicago at Ebon's Accelerate event this year. And I was really fascinated by this, really kind of the first opportunity that I had to kind of go deep into what you guys do. And I'm very excited to kind of bring that to our listeners today, because I think what you talk about, rapid scale, is kind of a fascinating topic. And I mentioned in your intro, Brian, that, you know, it's not often that you meet somebody who's been able to be involved on any level in a company that scales to $1 billion, but to be somebody who's been with seven companies who've scaled to $1 billion, you guys have probably learned a thing or two in observation, even just being in that environment.
Jennifer and I have definitely learned a lot. We've been really fortunate to see the inside of what it looks like in the executive staff room when you have 12 employees at a startup and you're dreaming of being a $1 billion company, and the kinds of things people say. You know, we have to do it this way because that, you know, if we don't, we'll drop, you know, we'll cap it at $100 million, and we want to be a $1 billion company. And then we've gotten to see over the years which ones of those companies and which ones of those kinds of decisions actually make it and hit that inflection point, and which ones kind of chug along or fizzle out. And over the last 15 or 20 years, we've gotten to see the patterns, really, and what the indications are that that's going to happen or that's not going to happen, and what you can do from inside the company, even if it's just you, even if it's just, you know, you and your cat. You could be sitting on an acorn, which is the seed that grows into a mighty oak tree, or you could be sitting on an apple seed, you know, and have a crab apple tree, which is one of the shortest trees there is. So even if it's just you, we've learned the patterns of what are the activities that lead to growth and what can you do to make that happen rapidly.
And you've got a really sort of systematic approach to it, which is something that I really love. I mean, I took pages and pages of notes at Ebon's event. And then even in our conversations, privately after that, you guys have been very helpful, even just with the issues that I deal with. And so I want to get this message out there as much as we can.
Yeah. I think, one of the things that we, that, you know, that's important to us is helping entrepreneurs overcome the overwhelm, that they feel. And, you know, what we've done here is put it together in a step-by-step, easy to follow, plan that shows you what you have to go through if you're starting a company all the way from early phase and then growing it all the way to scalability phase when you're looking at creating, you know, real wealth and billions of dollars. And there's an easy to follow set of steps and a path that we've seen over and over that applies to big companies and small companies that, you know, that we want to share so that you're not overwhelmed. You can find where you're at and look at what step do you need to do next instead of you know, looking at everything you haven't done. So it's a real important mm-hmm. key to being able to apply all of this.
Well, you guys have you talk about three different phases that people go through, and that was really sort of eye-opening to me. I mean, it seems so, it just made so much sense when I heard you talk about it in Chicago. So I was hoping that maybe we could spend the time today kind of talking about the three phases.
Yeah, so let's dive into that. Basically, I think what we want to do is kind of tell you the story of a company, and that company okay. could be your company. And this is the story that every company goes through. Just like, you know, there's only three or four stories in Hollywood. And if you go to the movies, it's pretty much the same. There's the good guy and the bad guy. And, you know, sometimes the good guy gets the girl. These days, the good guy usually is the girl. But so the companies have the same kind of story, and it starts out in a startup phase where it's really just you, and it's kind of like the wild, wild west. So, Jennifer, why don't you dive in, and because I know you've had a lot of experience with startup companies. What's that like?
Yeah. So in phase one, you know, and again, as you're listening to this, find where you are in this story. And as you find where you are, you'll have a sense of where you need to focus on next. And, you know, make sure as you're listening that you don't skip around. It's really important to realize the phase you're in and not succumb to the temptation to start working on things that are way outside of the phase you're in now when you haven't really gotten the stuff done that needs to be done in that phase, such that you're setting yourself up for any of that stuff to be meaningful for you. So let's dive in. Let's talk a little bit about the startup phase. You know, the word startup has been co-opted by the Silicon Valley to refer to a specific type of technology startup that, you know, that back then it involved massive growth, a global product strategy, and heavy backing from capitalists and a founding team of super genius technologists. So, you know, that word was heavily used in the Silicon Valley, but that term startup, when used that way, really only represents about 10% of startups. The other 90% of startups are all the self-funded businesses that are based on an interest or a skill or an opportunity that are all trying to grow quickly and safely and are mostly bootstrapping. And so when we say startup, we mean all of those companies too. And really, you know, similar to being, you know, early in your development, you know, imagine being an infant, you know, the startup phase involves really vulnerable, a vulnerable phase and requires a lot of special care and attention. And so in this phase, it's really about one main thing, and which is getting the value equation right. And, you know, basically getting the value equation right is looking at, you know, what price your products and services are, and making sure that the value of those products and services are greater than the cost that it costs you to make them, and that your customers perceive the value much greater than you're charging. And so if you have that value equation right, where they are getting the better end of the deal and they're kind of giving you the thumbs up saying, yes, this has value, then you've got a kind of an indication that you've got the value equation right. Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting, isn't it? It feels like what a lot of businesses do is they just get so excited about their technology or their widget or their method or whatever it is, and they just want to get that out there without really taking the view that the end user, their client is actually going to get a result from using it.
Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I've seen entrepreneurs come to us and say, I just started my business and I'm working on a really fancy website and getting a nice firm to come do that. And I'm, you know, buying this really, really good automation system to manage my list and, you know, all sorts of activities along those lines, which are way far ahead of the game. You know, first you really need to focus on, okay, what is your value equation? Do you have it right? Are customers actually willing to give you money for your products and services without a lot of, resistance? And you've really got to start there before you start investing in your marketing and in your systems and on all sorts of other things that are absolutely critical in later stages, but aren't critical here. And one of the best ways to begin getting your value equation right is to really focus on what is your offer. You know, and look at two of the P's. We call it, every offer has four P's, and we look at two of them in the early stages. And those two are, what is your product and what is your promise? What is your product and what is your promise? And then what is the process that you're giving your product, away at? You know, what is the way that you fulfill on it? And so you want to really form a well-formed offer. And then see how that goes. Have sales conversations with people in order to get that value equation right.
Mm-hmm. You know,
I just love that because we were talking in Chicago and just saying how much this resonates with our 8 profit activators. You know, with the before unit really being about selecting your target market as profit activator 1, but then jumping forward and starting with the user in mind, starting with your client in mind and really thinking through what would be a dream come true for them. And can you get that result? Always, always focused on the result before you start, you know, focusing on the price and on the, you really want to focus on your ability to deliver the result and then figure out what that's worth and what the price is.
Yeah, there are a couple of dimensions in the startup phase when you're trying to get the value equation right that will determine how rapidly you grow. The first is whether or not you're focused on the value equation as your primary outcome. And this is something that we've seen a lot of where people are just getting going and they get engaged with all the different ways they could provide value to different customers. And particularly companies that are in more of a service kind of industry or a service business, they'll kind of invent a new company for every customer they meet. Because, you know, you need money and this person wants their cat rescued out of a tree and the other person wants a haircut. So you have a kind of a haircutting, cat rescuing business for a while. And you know what I mean? And then, and if you're spending time chasing opportunities, but not drawing a conclusion about something that, you could repeat where it's the same value equation, where, you know, you can kind of know that, oh yeah, this is generally the value I provide. This is how this is the value they get. And then this is what I can charge for it. And hey, it costs me less. Until you arrive at that conclusion, you're parked really in terms of growth. You may get more income or more revenue in the short term, but your company is not scaling or not growing in any kind of, way that builds on itself. So the first way to grow rapidly is in the startup phase to focus only on that value equation, not anything else. And then the second is that you want that value equation to have as wide a berth as possible. If I could use a sailing term, you want it to be really a big distance between the value the customers get and what it costs you to deliver it. And then you have a lot of flexibility on price. You can experiment with charging a little more, charging a little less. But if you can deliver to a customer, say, 10 times the value that it costs you to provide it, that's a wide range and you're going to have a lot of flexibility. That company's going to grow more quickly than if it's a narrower margin. You know what I mean?
I often see people, and tell me if this fits with what you're saying, one of the things that I see people do is they come into something with a preconceived notion that they're going to package up a $79 info product or $199, process or set of CDs or something like that, an info product, and they're coming into it with this preconceived notion of what it is that they're going to create, rather than thinking about what, you know, is ultimately the result that they're going to create. And if they were to just focus on creating that result, they may be able to charge 10 times more for the result than just limiting themselves by, you know, constraining it before they go into it.
Yeah, absolutely. We recommend that you actually pick your price last, not first. Mm-hmm. So, first you want to understand what's the biggest value that I could deliver, you know, and that value is expressed by, you know, what customers are comfortable, what do they get from that? What dollar value do they place on what they get? And if the price is the same as that value, then the customer doesn't care whether they buy it or not. In other words, if you have something you're selling and I give you exactly the right price for it, then you don't care whether I buy it or not. Because if I don't buy it, you have the thing. And if you do buy it, you have the money, which is the same value. So you don't want to be in a situation where your customers don't care whether they're doing business with you, right? So they have to get more. So you get the value nailed down first. Then you get your cost structure nailed down so you know what it takes you to deliver it. And then last thing you do is come in and go, okay, now what's my price strategy? You mentioned you could end up delivering a lot more value and charging a lot more for it. And that's one way to have more margin, more profit. One of our clients who was the founder of three companies, the least valuable of which was sold for $300 million, and the most recent of which is Quantcast, the audience measurement for measuring internet audiences. So mm-hmm. Paul Sutter is his name, and he said every time he does a company, he wants the customers to say, I'll take as much as you have, as soon as they find out what you're selling and what the price is. Like selling a dollar for 80 right. cents. I'll take as much as you have. And that kind of automatic, I'll take as much as you have, is a huge growth accelerator, because then you don't have to convince the customers to buy anything. All you have to do is let them know what it is you're selling and how to get it. And it's a very right. different process.
Yes. Yeah. That's, do you have, an example of something that would fit along that line?
Sure. So, Jennifer and I are currently investing in a company, a startup company, and this company provides done-for-you content marketing. So it will do your social media and your blog and your email and all of, those kinds of publish those things for you. We were talking with the CEO, and we're trying to come up with pricing. You know, what's it worth to an entrepreneur to have all of that done for you well, and done for it in your voice? And, we came up with the figure something like $1,500 to $2,000 a month is what it's worth. And we talked to people, and we probably could get that price from certain people. But then we said, what if we could offer it for $500 instead of $2,000? Mm-hmm. Because then, I can imagine entrepreneurs never canceling, not having to think about whether it's a thing that they should pay for or not. It doesn't matter whether they're making money this month or not. They just want to keep doing it. And so we drove the price down to $599, I think, is where we ended up. And then the question was, okay, how do we drive that cost down so that we can actually produce a high quality product at that price? So that's an example of just, going towards velocity versus margin. And, especially in like any kind of reoccurring revenue business where you've got a subscription, because boy, that average profit per customer really adds up if they don't cancel in 6 years and 7 years versus you get them for three right, months exactly. at 1500 to 2000. And then they're like, well, geez, uh-huh. this is expensive.
It strikes me that in the startup phase, it's important to be able to push the accelerator pedal and see the long-term potential of the offer or the business that you're entering into.
If you just respond to the customers and what they need, and kind of if you let your email box determine your calendar, then you're not going to grow very rapidly. You might not grow at all, because each time you go from one phase to the next, you have to do a sort of unnatural act. You have to do something very counterintuitive, because the once you get the value equation right and you're kind of exiting that startup phase and you're into the next phase, your whole mind has to change about everything that everything you're doing, and you have to be slightly less responsive to customers, and it just you would never be able to do that unless you weren't looking at the long term and understanding right. that you're running this thing through a series of gates or through a series of thresholds, and you want to you want to compress the time as much as possible.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it seems like in the beginning, the getting the value equation right, you're sort of over investing in the fulfillment of it, in the using it as kind of a R&D lab in a way to figure out and get really behind the scenes and see what things, how it actually works, how people are experiencing it, what they perceive, what's working and what's not working, to get it all tweaked, I guess, right? And ready to go.
Yes, absolutely. Once the value equation's nailed down, and you know that you have not just one customer or two customers, but you can see that if you meet a customer with a kind of particular profile or particular situation, you can slam dunk. You can deliver value. It's going to be awesome for them, and it's going to cost you less than the price. Then you really need to move into the next phase, which is the sustainability phase. And Jennifer, I thought you might share some stuff about that too.
I just wanted to interject about startup real quick, though. I'd like to kind of underscore, there are kind of two main vectors to play with to optimize growth in the startup phase. And, one vector, as Brian said, that I just want to underscore is that you want to increase the customer's perception of the value that your offering is dramatically. And that way you have a lot of flexibility. If they are feeling like it's a huge, huge value and it's a no-brainer for them to invest, then that gives you a lot of flexibility around your costs. And so make sure that you're looking to optimize that vector along with setting the price so far that you have people that want to come on board very, very, very quickly. So if you lower the price to the no-brainer price and you increase their perception of value simultaneously and you optimize between those two, you're optimizing between having good profits, which is setting the value high, and speed of adoption, which is creating a price that's a no-brainer for them to adopt very, 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 very quickly. And there's like an optimal level of optimizing for those two vectors that will allow for rapid growth. And so that's kind of a process that you look at when you're getting your value equation right in startup. So that's that phase. So really when you're in that phase, that's what you're doing. You're not doing anything else. But once you've got that right, and it's an easy yes, and they're getting the better end of the deal, it's time to move forward and into our second phase. And the second phase is what we call the sustainability phase. And this phase is really about three things. It's about having your business become predictable, repeatable, and replenishable. And what I mean by that is, when you look at the major business activities that you're going to be spending most of your time in, look at, let's say, starting with, marketing, right? You've got your marketing as one of those major business activities. You've got sales as another major business activity. And then you've got fulfillment as another big activity. And then what makes up the rest is profit, right? And, there's kind of a dotted line that we draw between profit and overhead because that is often quite arbitrary, right? How much you tend to spend on the overhead of your business depends on whether you have your office in a big palace on you know, some main street in a big metropolitan city, whether you've got your Learjets taking you back and forth to your meetings, or whether you've got, you know, a home-based business where you're running with a remote team, you know, and so that would change the nature of your profit and your overhead. But really what you want to do is look at making your marketing repeatable, predictable, and replenishable. You want to make your sales repeatable, predictable, and replenishable. You want to make your fulfillment repeatable, predictable, and replenishable. And sometimes the way I talk about that is it's like creating a crank for your business. And you know what I mean by a crank is a good visual image, because with a crank, you have a you know, a known quantity of like effort in, which yields a known quantity of work or result out. Right. And so imagine in your business, if you will, that you had a marketing crank, so that you knew if you turned this crank, you would yield a predictable amount of profits and revenue, or a predictable amount of leads would come out the other side. A predictable amount of people would start hearing about you and opting into your offers. A predictable amount of people would start calling you up at your business to ask about how they can have your services or your products. So what you really want to do in this phase is create those cranks for each area so that you've got them predictable, repeatable, and replenishable. That's super important. And, you know, often what happens as you're listening and looking for where you are in the story is you'll have one of these set up as a crank, but not the rest. You know, perhaps you have automated your lead flow. You've got a predictable, repeatable, and replenishable amount of leads. But maybe what we see often is that entrepreneurs haven't created a predictable, repeatable, replenishable flow with either their sales or their fulfillment. And you can see that they can't really move on to really grow rapidly until they've got that, because one aspect of their business will break. And if they send too many leads to fulfillment and they haven't gotten a really nice, repeatable, predictable way of cranking out fulfillment, then all the efforts in perfecting that marketing crank are going to be, you know, wasted. And so you really want to create all three of these before you move forward. And that's the next phase.
It's kind of funny, because what I often see is people, you know, the marketing crank, you can, the good news about it is that it is by nature sort of scientific and repeatable. If you're using direct response marketing, you can sort of deploy something and generate a lot of leads. And then what I often see is people get caught up or get surprised by the volume of leads that they're able to generate, and they're not able to handle the conversion of those or the fulfillment of those. And you end up like Lucy at the chocolate factory with all the leads coming, and they're coming in too fast, and they can't you know, deal with them all. So they have to shut down the line for a little bit to kind of catch up, and then they get back in the beginning because they're not busy anymore, and they have to crank it up again.
Yeah, exactly. I'll sometimes call it, and I think I've even heard you say this, Dean, is you've got holes in your bucket. You're pouring a whole lot of leads in, and they're just kind of through the holes in the bottom, they're just kind of flowing all the way out. And, you know, you're leaving a lot of money on the table, and you're losing a lot of steam in your business and your ability to grow, because you haven't figured out how to capture those and have all three of those cranks really forming one machine that's well-oiled and running smoothly. And that's really what you want to do in this phase. You know, for us, for instance, you know, a good example of a marketing crank, since we brought it up, is for us, a teleseminar is a really good marketing crank for us. So, you know, we've used these successfully in our businesses, and they yield a predictable and repeatable and replenishable source of revenue for us. So if you've got a business where you use these, you'll relate. You know, we partner with someone who has a list. They invite them to a teleseminar, which we host. Then we provide valuable content to everyone on the call. At the end, we talk about our products and services. And then they enter our sales funnel. Now, teleseminars are completely repeatable. We can do them over and over. We can do many of them. We can do them with different people. They're replenishable insofar as the minute we do one, it's not like all the leads on the planet have disappeared and you can't replenish those sources and continue to do more. And then they're predictable. We know based on how many people come, about how many people are going to eventually become customers. And that's a percentage mm-hmm. that we've calculated from having done these and refined them and gotten better and better. And so just to kind of make it real for the listeners, that's an example of a marketing crank where you've got it predictable, repeatable, and replenishable.
Mm-hmm. You know, go ahead.
Go ahead, Bart.
Oh, I was just going to say,
when you're doing that, the whole, and it can be anything. It can be a predictable pay-per-click mm-hmm. campaign mm-hmm. where you set up on Google AdWords, where you know that your clicks are going to cost you, 50 cents or a dollar. And you know that when 100 people come, that 20 of them are going to leave their name and their email address. That's sort of a repeatable thing. Or if you've got a postcard campaign where you can mail 1,000 postcards and you're going to get, to get 100 opt-ins from sending people to that same page, or any of those things that are going to work again. I think you guys call those things assets, right? Is that what you call the?
Yes. Yeah, okay. we have an important distinction around assets, which we call those assets for a specific reason, because we want people to have the relationship to those things that they actually are a valuable piece of their business that is worth investing in. And it's not just about, mm-hmm. Taking an action here and there that emulates a role model, but it's really about building an asset that is valuable to the business and that you can actually use to generate your leads. And so, yes, I would call a pay-per-click campaign that actually yields revenue for you, an asset, and one that doesn't, as an incomplete or not a very well-oiled crank that you still need to refine. And the more erratic it is, or the more non-predictable and non-replenishable it is, the less it becomes an asset and the more it becomes a drain. And it's really important to know the difference and to really build it such that it is an asset that you can tap.
In this phase, sometimes I think of the assets, those little wind-up dolls where you twist them and they kind of hop on the table. I sometimes think of the business as all these little assets. You got your pay-per-click campaign or your teleseminars and your relationships with joint venture partnerships, or you have, my mom's marketing crank when she was a successful executive coach years ago before there was such a thing as an executive coach. She would say she was a coach and people would say, well, what sport? So her marketing crank was that every year for Thanksgiving, she would write notes to all of her past clients, telling them what she was thankful for about them. And then by January, some number of them would come back to her with more work. That was kind of how she did it. So you have all these little cranks and these little wind up dolls that are jumping on the table. And a good clue that you've got a crank is that if you crank it harder, if you invest more time or money into it, then you should get more out of it. So the pay-per-click, the campaign that you mentioned, if you increase your bid price or if you invest more time and money in it, you'll get more leads out. The teleseminars, if you do more of them, you'll get more leads out. So then you can mm-hmm. modulate how big your business is basically by how hard you're working at that phase. And, you mentioned the people who aren't ready for the influx of leads. I also see people who are afraid of that, so they never start and kind of stop mm-hmm. it at the startup mode, and they don't really get the cranks going because they're worried. Just to help people out, focus on getting your fulfillment crank ready, but maybe not started first, so you know you can fulfill. If people come in, you can please them. You can give them the service that you promise. And then do your marketing crank. And if you have a lot of leads and you can't close them and you're leaving money on the table while you figure out your sales crank, that's fine. So do your fulfillment, at least set it up. If not, press go. Then you get your marketing crank going. Then get your sales crank going. And if you end up with a lot of leads and you're closing them, but it's more than you can handle, that's the time to introduce partnerships where you're giving leads and business to other people. Everybody loves partners that want to give you money and give you business. So it's really easy to find partners who, have extra fulfillment, extra capacity, but don't have the leads or the sales. And if you end up owning the leads and the sales and owning those cranks, you're going to have plenty of time and plenty of money to invest in fulfillment over time to round it out. So if you do it in the right sequence, you think about your fulfillment crank first, then you build the marketing one, then you build the sales one, and then lastly you press go on that fulfillment one. If you do that in that right sequence, then every step is easy. And if you're struggling and it's hard, then you've probably done it in the wrong order.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's important to note that there's nothing, these are kind of things that you can develop on a smaller scale. You know, there's nothing, I often see people, you know, spend a lot of money, like they want to send out 20,000 postcards right out of the gate when they could test, and they haven't even tested whether this works, when you could get the answer for much less money, you know, to make sure that you're on the right track.
Yeah, no reason to scale your crank before you've tested and know that it's actually a working one, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
I just want to, Brian brought up the idea of partnerships, which are key because you can't scale a business and grow it really rapidly without partnerships, working all alone. In order to really set yourself up to do that and to grow, you really need to understand some very important numbers in your business. You need to understand what we'll call the cost structure of your business. So let me walk through that just a bit. Earlier I said that, you know, you look at your business and you look at the four major activities of the business, and pretty much everything you're doing in your business will fit into one of these four activities. And, when you're looking at the cost structure of your business, what we want you to do is for every dollar of revenue your business is making, you need to allocate that revenue into these major activities. You know, so how much of every dollar by percentage is allocated to your marketing? How much of every dollar is allocated to your sales? How much to your fulfillment? And then how much to your profit and overhead? Right? And so, you really want to get these right. Because if you understand in your industry how, that revenue should be allocated, it allows you to enter into partnerships with confidence because, you know, let's say you want to, enter into a partnership with someone who's going to handle, let's say, your marketing. You know that marketing in your industry is approximately worth, let's say, 40% of that revenue. And if someone comes in with a deal and asks for, you know, 60% or 80%, you know whether you can afford it, whether it's going to be sustainable, because you know that you're spending the rest of those dollars on your sales, your fulfillment, and your overhead. And so it allows you, by knowing this cost structure, to know exactly how to enter into these partnerships. And it also gives you the discipline of knowing how to value your time, effort, and energy within your business and what you ought to be spending on each of those activities. You know, if you want to grow and you find out you're spending $0 zero time on your marketing and you're wondering why aren't you growing, well, maybe it's time that you need to spend 40% if that's your cost industry or that's your industry model, 40% of your time, your money, and your resources on that. If you're not selling and you're not converting and you're realizing you're not spending that time and that money in investing in that area of your business, perhaps it's time for you to do that. And so the idea when you're setting this cost structure up is you know, it's not just a guessing game. What you want to do is you want to look at what is kind of standard in your industry. And it's dramatically different from industry to industry. But you look at your industry and you want to be kind of within a reasonable range of what is standard for your industry so that when you're trying to, work with vendors within that your industry or partners or customers that you're fitting within, where your industry is at. Go ahead.
That brings up two questions for me then.
Yeah.
So for everybody, what distinction do you make between marketing and sales?
Sure. I think, one of our definitions for marketing and sales is marketing is about getting people who don't know about you to know about you. Right. And so that's really marketing. So the minute someone goes from not knowing about you to knowing about you, you've successfully marketed to them. Now they know about you. So in, right. in sales, it's about getting somebody that knows about you to purchase your product. Right. So it's a slightly different.
So this is like, and you know, I'd say how resonant this stuff is with the eight profit activators.
Oh, good,
so,
good.
You know, we look at like profit activator two is getting them to raise their hand, turning an invisible prospect into a visible prospect. Mm-hmm. Profit activator three is about educating and motivating them. And profit activator four is about making an offer. And those things would be kind of the distinction between marketing and sales. So it's, I know everybody that's listening is familiar with our eight profit activators. And that really is the essence of your before unit, that distinction between marketing and sales. So thanks for clearing that up.
Yeah, that maps really well.
I had was then how does somebody know in their industry, you talk about the standards or the norm for their industry. Where can somebody get information like that? Or how would they know what is appropriate?
Well, the slam dunk way is to meet people who are your competitors and who are in the industry, who've been in the industry for a long time and become their mm-hmm. friends. You know, we're seeing this trend more and more that the idea of competition is kind of fading away and it's being replaced by the idea that we're in this together. And if you're trying to provide value, like I know, you know, Dina, one of your activities for this blog is you're trying to help entrepreneurs be more successful and have the information they need to have an easier time reaching their goals, right? One of your goals is it should be as easy as possible for an entrepreneur to once they intend to do something, for them to be successful in doing it. Well, Jennifer and I have the same goal. So I suppose you could squint and say we're kind of competitors because you're helping them and we're helping them, but I think that's kind of silly. It's actually more what we're seeing, that we can connect and be friends on the level of what we're both committed to, which is the value mm-hmm. that we want to give the entrepreneur in the first place. And if you're doing that and I'm doing that and Jennifer's doing that, and we're all doing it together, then the more people that get helped, the more all of us have done what we came here to do, and we can kind of feel mm-hmm. gratified in that. So once you have that mindset, then you know, you have a beer with your friend Dean and it's like, hey man, what do you pay for sales? Like, well, you got a sales guy and it works for you. So what's your commission rate and how's that work? And do you have any management? Do you have any software that you have to pay for? And are there any other sales expenses that are kind of hidden in there that I don't know about? So I'm trying to figure out what that percentage is and how that works for me. So that's the best way. We'll give you a shortcut. For service professionals, you can count on fulfillment being about 50% of revenue. I don't know, Jennifer, you want to talk about the marketing and the sales pieces of those for the service folks?
Well, yeah, I would just say, like, if you're looking at, you know, let's say look like a consulting business, like a coaching business like ours, right? For our business, for instance, the coaching side of our business, not the program side, you know, our fulfillment is about 50%. You know, what we would pay for anyone managing all of the sales activities, which is not just a commission, but anything relating to sales, that's between 10 to 15%. Marketing for our business is about 5 to 10%. Overhead should be about 10% or less, and then profit leaves you about 20%. And so that would be a typical service business, right? But if we were to look at a completely different business, like let's look at a car company, right? It's like selling a Honda. Right. The fulfillment in that case would be about 80-90%, right? Because the cost of the car itself is the lion's share of, you know, of the revenue structure. And then the 20% left over is actually split between sales, marketing, and profit. And so those are two very, very different models, to look at. And, your industry, if you're more towards the service side, is going to have a higher percentage towards marketing and sales. And if you're more towards the product side, the idea is you'll probably have a higher percentage towards fulfillment. And we consider many people that probably listen to your show who are in the industry of creating products and programs online, we still kind of classify that as closer to a service, even though you could technically buy a physical, tangible CD, really what you're doing is you're offering the service of education and help. And so it's kind of in that area in between. And so rather than fulfillment being 50%, you know, I'd say an internet marketing company's got more of a where the marketing is around 40%, your sales is around 20%, your fulfillment is around 30%, and then the remainder is around profit, and overhead. And so that's a generalized, a set of models that fit quite a few industries, all the way from a full-on consulting-based service business to a product business to a kind of hybrid in between, which is your programs and online. And so those are some good rules of thumb. Mm-hmm. But really what Brian said about reaching out, that will give you a sense, you know, reach out to the people in your industry. Realize that there's nonlinear growth available if you all band together and collaborate and contribute to one another. It really unlocks growth potential. And so we really recommend reaching out to those, having mentors and advisors that can help you find out what it is for your industry, and then reaching out to the people that are really directly in your industry as well.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess another real quick key, and then we'll move on to the next phase is, you know, even if you're wearing a lot of hats in your business, right? And, you know, you look at us and say, well, wait a minute, Brian and Jennifer, you know, I'm, you know, the chief marketing officer and the chief salesperson and the, one to fulfill and,
chief janitorial officer,
all the profit, right? Chief janitorial officer and the chief garbage officer and all of that. And if you're in sustainability phase and still feeling that way, really it's important to have the discipline, to separate those activities in your mind. And just start to notice the different activities that you're doing. You know, are you right now generating a new lead, or are you turning them into a customer, or are you working on your product or fulfillment? Which of those activities are you doing? How much of your time and energy and efforts are you spending? And keep track and make sure that it all makes sense given your model. Because what we find is most entrepreneurs are scratching their heads going, why am I not growing? And when we actually have them take it apart and look at how they're spending their time and energy and resources, even if it's all them, it becomes super clear. It's like, oh, you're not spending any time on selling. So you're not closing any leads. You're spending, you know, 1 hour a week, and you really want to be converting. And if we know how many sales conversations you have with a predictable crank, you have to have 10 hours of sales to yield one customer out, let's say as an example, then you need to be doing, you know, that many hours of sales, 10 hours of sales in order to get your one customer. And if one customer is all you need each week to create a sustainable business, then you know what your time is, right? And that's the percentage of time out of your full day. And so it's a really important exercise, even if you're an entrepreneur with a very small team, or even if it's just you as a solopreneur. So just want to underscore that, because you cannot move into sustainability phase before you've created those cranks and then figured out this cost structure. And then and only then do you move on to the next phase, which is really where it gets interesting, which is scalability.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's really kind of an interesting, you know, dilemma, is that often, you know, if they're working the crank for the marketing and the sales, and then they get caught up in that they're so busy delivering that they don't have time to go back. I think part of the thing is to really kind of observe it as a process. Have you guys ever seen that show, How It's Made, on Discovery?
I've heard of it.
Where they go through and they, show manufacturing processes of how they make, you know, bowling balls or how they make light bulbs. And it's, you know, they narrate the process from the raw materials all the way through the assembly line. And at every step along the way, they're describing what happens next and what happens next. And one of the things that I would use as a example of that is trying to imagine creating the narrative for your business process to say, this is how it works. We run ads on Google pay-per-click, and whenever somebody finds the word Winter Haven, Florida real estate, they see our ad and they come to our website and they leave their name and their email address. And then every week we send them a newsletter that's got all the updates of all of the new properties that come on the market. And we invite them to come on a daily tour of homes, or to come to a home buyer workshop, or to get a free every home loan report, and, you know, X percent of the people that do that engage in a conversation with us, and then we're able to help them find a home or come and sit with them about selling their home. And so, you know, kind of imagining yourself narrating your process. And if you can't narrate, you know, seamlessly how the whole throughput system works, that's gives you an indication of really what you need to work on. But it also gives you an opportunity to imagine that part of the process happening without you, imagining that somebody else is doing it. One of my favorite things in that How It's Made show is that they describe sometimes a process that involves human intervention, and they say a worker takes this and does this, and it's just so kind of like, it was kind of interesting that it's just in their minds, a worker, you know, is a human, you know, mm-hmm. machine that does this specific thing. And it's kind of, you know, one of my kind of buzzwords is, you know, human automation is still automation, right? To mm-hmm. you, it doesn't mm-hmm. matter whether it's a human or a machine, as long as it is being done, that's automation.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I just want to say about this sustainability phase is that the sad news for us when you know, we've, you know, observed thousands of entrepreneurs is that this phase tends to be where most people park. You know, this is the step in our experience mm-hmm. where most entrepreneurs stop
they
developing.
They never figured this out, right? Or just this constant dance of, you know, going back and forth between being too busy or being not busy enough and, you know, dancing through all the parts.
Yeah. Yeah.
I see that all the time. It's just amazing how that you're absolutely right. That's where they get stuck.
Yeah. You know, these first two phases are really, focused on generating, income. Right. And what you end up with if you stop at sustainability phase is that you end up with a lifestyle business, and it makes you just enough money to give you a lifestyle that you're comfortable with. You know, last I checked, there's no wealth. You know, you're really dodging the wealth bullet, as we'll sometimes say, if you stop here. Because you know, it's not until you move into this third phase, the scalability phase, that wealth actually occurs. You know, here's mm-hmm. when you really are all about automating, delegating, and outsourcing, right? So the scalability phase, you're automating, delegating, outsourcing, and what you're really doing in some ways is working yourself outside out of a job, right? You're being a job creator at this point and taking every area of your business, your marketing, your sales, your fulfillment, your profit and overhead even, and looking at how do I automate that? How do I delegate that? How do I outsource that? Such that, you know, everybody that comes in gets to add to and form their own multiplier and their own crank and then expand it from there. And what we see is the big pitfall in this phase so often, which has people not really move into it, is that they believe that they're the only one that can do the job. Can't tell you how many times the arrogance of, no, you don't understand, Brian and Jennifer, I can't outsource or delegate the fulfillment, or nobody but me can write my copy. You know, I'm the only one that knows how to write the marketing for my business. Right. And I'm just the best.
Nobody can paint a house like me, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, I'm the only one who can paint a house like me, right? Sorry, go ahead.
And that may be true.
Yeah. And well, what we find when people have that belief, it's usually because they don't fully understand what the magic fairy dust that they're using that's creating the success in their business. And because they don't quite understand it fully, it seems to happen because of their unconscious competence, that they don't mm-hmm. actually know how to outsource it, delegate it, automate it, and have other people do it. And therefore, they're perpetually stuck because they're the kind of limiter for their own business. So the thing that mm-hmm. had you become the most valuable entrepreneur, the thing that had you wearing all those hats and willing to work all night and be the janitor on one day and be the salesperson on the other, that very thing that got you here, that got you to a sustainable business with a crank, is the very thing that's in your way to actually generate wealth and grab that brass ring at the end of the game. So, what you really want to do is work yourself out of a job and create a position such that you understand it well enough that a monkey could run your business. And when I say that, I always get a sideways glance. Like, what do you mean a monkey could run your business? And really, if you're creating a business that only geniuses could run, imagine if it's you and only the few geniuses on the planet that are capable of running your business, and that's how you see it, then how big can you really get? How can you really scale? Well, you can't. And when I say monkey, what I actually mean is maybe not quite so literally a monkey, but what I mean is like so that an average person coming into that position would do well.
Are you saying average people are monkeys? Is that what you're saying?
Well, not exactly.
It kind of resonates that Warren Buffett has said that in his organization, operationally, his role could be filled by a cardboard cutout of him.
Right, right. Well, then he gets it, you know, and look at the size and scale of everything that Warren Buffett touches. And Richard Branson, who's got 300
companies. Again, though, that the, we had our, episode with, Richard Branson.
Oh, great.
And he had said, you know, cause Yannick Silver asked him, what's the, you know, secret to scaling to, you know, to $1 billion. How do you do that? You're running 300 or 400 companies and all of that. And Richard he said, well, first of all, you can't do anything. You have to kind of be able to get out of the way, you know, set the vision and find and trust competent people to do their best work, you know, and stay out of their way.
Absolutely.
That's really the biggest mindset shift to help people get into scalable mode full force. Like Jennifer said, if you recognize that you don't know the value that you provide every time you think you're the only one that can do it, because what people think now is that other people that they're hiring aren't as good. You know, I can't hire any salespeople because I can't find any good salespeople. And anytime you have that thought, I can't hire someone because I can't find anyone who can do it, what you need to do is go, wait a minute, that's actually a trick. And the truth is that I'm doing something and I don't know what it is. And if I examine what it is and find out, then I'll easily be able to find the people to hire to do that. And if you don't do that, you end up just scaling the one piece of your business, which doesn't generate any revenue, which is entrepreneurs scale their overhead. They tend to scale that piece first, you know, so they'll get an assistant and then the bookkeeper and then a lawyer. And you know, pretty soon you have four or five people helping on the overhead piece. But you're still holding all the weight yourself in the sales, marketing, fulfillment.
Yeah. I just
so
want to underline.
It's really about figuring out what it is that you're, what is the magic and figuring out how to bottle it, package it, and pass it on to somebody who can fulfill that role for you.
Yeah. You know, companies that scale are led by people who continually are investigating where and how value is being produced in their organization.
Yeah.
And then innovating ways of communicating, educating, and rewarding those capabilities. Right. So your new job
It seems like even if you can get somebody who could do it 80% as good as you, but the way that things are set up, you only get to spend 20 or 30% of your time doing it the way you do it. You know, that if somebody was able to do it 80% as well as you, but they were able to do that 100% of the time, that's a big scalability. And you could get five people doing it 80% as good as you.
Yeah.
That's scalability there.
Yeah.
And this is where the monkey comes back in, because, if the difference between 80% and 100% is significant in your business, if your business is riding on that difference, then you have to go back to the drawing board. Your value equation is probably screwed up. It's probably relying too much on you and your specific genius in order to pull out that value. If you can redesign the business so it's easier to provide more value and a larger population can easily provide the high value that you've got because you've developed a system or you've developed a process or you've developed an approach, or you've identified a need that nobody else had identified. You know, if you can if you can make it easy, so then the difference between 80% and 100% really is nothing. Then you definitely get out of it. But as long as you're taking up all the roles, then you'll never have a team and you'll only have one man year per year to work on your business versus 5, 10, 100, 500, 5,000 man years per year.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's kind of...
Yeah, here you're shifting from generating income, which is primarily your activity in the first two phases, to here you're literally building assets and you're building positions inside the company that are profitable job descriptions, right? So that everybody that you bring on board adds to the bottom line, adds to the ability to market, sell, and fulfill on your products, such that if every employee or every contractor, everyone that you partnered with, created at least 2x what you're paying them in bottom line revenue, wouldn't you take as many, as you could? Just like the Paul Sutter phrase, you know, I'll take as many as you've got. If everybody that you added to your system was hired in such a way that they were a profitable job description, and then it was just a matter of taking a month or two to see if they were ramping up and creating that 2x, then you're going to want to just continually hire and continually create jobs and continually create impact on a much, much, much bigger scale. And that's really what this phase is about, is getting good at doing that.
You know, if you imagine scaling or automating, delegating and outsourcing your marketing and then your sales and then your fulfillment, the next thing that gets automated is your profit. And if your profit is your income, then automated profit is wealth. And that's when you first have, it's actually the first time that an entrepreneur can start to engage in the idea of creating wealth is once they're well on their way to scalability. And as Jennifer said earlier, in that sustainability phase, you're trapped in a business that you can't quit. You can't leave it. You can't quit it. People depend on you to keep doing it, but it's never going to make you wealthy.
Yeah.
Well, so I can't believe how fast the time's flying here, but in our last few minutes kind of thing, what would be your kind of summary advice for the three, phases, just as kind of a quick review and maybe some action items for people?
Sure. So if you're in the startup phase, you got to focus all your attention on getting the value equation right and having the widest distances possible between the value that you're actually providing, that the customer actually receives, not that you're telling them they will, but the value they actually get, and the cost that it costs you to deliver that.
Yeah. And then in sustainability phase, it's about creating a crank for your business such that your marketing, sales, and fulfillment are predictable, repeatable, and replenishable. So you really want to focus on creating that crank so that a known amount of energy in yields a known amount of revenue and opportunity out. And then secondarily during that phase, you want to understand the cost structure of business, understand those 4 or 5 numbers, know those percentages well, so that you can begin to enter partnerships that help you grow.
Once you're in the scalable phase, then your job changes. Your first job changes from creating value for customers to creating valuable jobs. And so you have to be creative about thinking about what Jennifer and I call profitable job descriptions. You got to create job descriptions where if someone fills the job description, they generate 2, 3, 4 times the value for the company that they cost in terms of their salary and benefits. So you create those job descriptions and you fill them. And in doing so, you're automating, you're delegating, or you're outsourcing first marketing and then sales and then fulfillment. And then you have a fully scalable business where your last job that you hold is holding the vision and leadership. And that's when you actually get wealth and then you get that brass ring, you know, the reason entrepreneurs go into business for themselves in the first place, when you poll them, there's two main reasons, which are number one, freedom, and number two, wealth. And the way to get freedom in your time and generate wealth financially is you have to get through these gates that we just said as quickly as possible, and developing the next phase of your business is higher urgency and more important than any customer concern, than any short-term fire that you're putting out, than any email in your inbox. So prioritize that first, and then make room or make time after you're doing that, after you've done that, for handling the day-to-day.
So you've got to be prepared that it's okay that some people might slip through the cracks, or that you might not be delivering the level of service that you were able to deliver when that was your sole focus, and be okay with that, knowing that in the greater good, this is going to be the long-term
picture. So in closing, I'll give you an image. I think sometimes being an entrepreneur is like being a ping pong player, and you're playing against, you know, the world champion Olympic ping pong player, and the balls are coming at you at a really fast rate. And you just, all you can do to kind of bat each one back. And what you got to do is intentionally let one go by and use that time to lean over and pick up a brick and put the brick on the ping pong table. And if you keep doing that, pretty soon you have a brick wall that's automatically bouncing all the ping pong balls back, and you don't have to swing the paddle at all. But if you keep swinging at every ball, you know, you're never going to, if you keep swinging at every ball, you're never going to pick up a brick, and you're just going to swing at every ball from here on out. So you do have to be willing to let things go occasionally, you know, this one or that one, in order to put something in place that can build your future. And that ultimately is in service to the larger market and to what the value that you want to provide your customers.
Guys, this has just been so valuable. I think this is going to be one of the episodes that people listen to again and again and again and get something different out of it every time, and listen to it maybe every quarter and get a different thing when they're at a different level in their business. So thank you so much for taking the time to share with us. It's fascinating to me. I just think you guys are doing such a great thing, and you've got a lot of really simple to understand ways to look at rapidly scaling your business. So I appreciate you.
Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having us, Dean.
Yeah, thank you, Dean. This was a lot of fun, and I'm just really pleased that we can help people out and help them scale their businesses.
Perfect. Now, how can people get more information if they want to kind of seek you out and go deeper with this?
Yeah, there's so we have a lot of ways that we work with entrepreneurs to help them grow and scale their businesses. And around this topic on our website, mindmoneymeaning.com, we have a link. If you say mindmoneymeaning.com/createwealth. And on that link, you'll find us going way, way deeper into this topic. You'll have a report for each of the different phases. We'll talk more about how to do cost structuring of your business. You'll see a video of us talking through it. We'd love to share that with anyone that heard this call. It's totally free. You can find it at mindmoneymeaning.com/createwealth. We'd love to share those with you and your audience.
Perfect. Great. And I'll put up a link to that on ilovemarketing.com too. I think what I'm going to do is put up a picture of the image that was with the circle and the lines that show, because that's kind of a central visual to what we've been talking about. That was really what kind of hit home for me when I saw you talk about this in Chicago. So I'm going to put up that visual for people too. So if you're just listening on iTunes right now, if you go to ilovemarketing.com, you'll see a visual that really kind of helps cement this in your mind, so you know what we're kind of talking about. And then I'll put up the link to where you can download their information too. So guys, thank you again. It's been phenomenal. I look forward to revisiting this. I think it'd be good to maybe have another episode very soon and go a little deeper with this. So I appreciate it.
That'd be great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.